Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Disability rights is a global social and civil rights movement that advocates for equal opportunities, accessibility, and freedom from discrimination. The goal is to ensure that people with disabilities participate fully and equally in society free from barriers in employment, healthcare, architecture, and education. It has been more than 35 years since President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. Yet despite many years of advocacy, the scope and breadth and goals of the movement are less well known than activism for racial and sex equality. So I thought I would look into the movement to recount its successes and explore goals yet to be achieved. My guest today is Melissa Ortiz, founder and principal of Capability Consulting, an award-winning speaker and self-described relentlessly resilient warrior princess. At Capability Consulting, she advises on ADA compliance, accessibility, and disability policy. She served as a presidential appointee and has written op-eds for USA Today, The Washington Examiner, and other publications. She has been interviewed by numerous TV and radio outlets, including BBC, Fox News, and One America News. She has also served as a visiting fellow for the Independent Women's Forum, and in 2005 served as Ms. Wheelchair New York. She is now the vice president of the board of the Spina Bifida Patients Association. Melissa currently resides in the Washington, D.C. area with her husband, Tony, and service dog, Annie Oakley, a chocolate brindle dachshund. Melissa, welcome to Humanize.
Thanks, Wesley. I'm delighted to be here.
I take it Annie Oakley is a straight shooter.
She is. She is. And she even has had at one point a little rhinestone gun on her harness.
Good for you. You know, you're an entrepreneur and an activist. What attracted you to the disability rights movement?
Well, I myself have a disability. I was born with all kinds of medical problems, and they finally didn't put a final diagnosis on me until 2008, if you can believe it. And I was already well into my adult years by that point. And so they did not put that diagnosis on me until then. I was born 2 months early. My mother nearly died during the cesarean to save her life, and they did not have a heartbeat for me when I was born. And so ultimately, I was not supposed to live through the delivery process. Then they figured out that I had lived. I was laying over in the incubator humming. And then they said, well, she's not going to live a year. And I did. And then they said, well, she won't. Yeah. Then she's not going to live to graduate high school. And I did. And so when I graduated college, they said, we don't know what to expect from her. So we'll just study her and see, and we'll follow her around and see what happens next.
So now you're a specimen.
Exactly. Exactly. A lot of times I feel like a bug under a microscope. I was born into a world that was not friendly toward kids with disabilities. We were cute. We were poster child worthy, but we weren't considered actual participants in the American fabric. And the only reason that I got what I needed at school was because my very Southern mama bear went to school and fought for it, because I started before the 1974 Rehab Act, which mandated that every child that could be educated needed to have a fair and appropriate public education. So that is what that's kind of how I came to it. I realized that.
If I may ask, were you using a wheelchair at that time?
No, I was not. I did start first grade in a wheelchair because I had had surgery the summer before, but by Thanksgiving, I was out of the wheelchair and on my crutches, which is a good thing because we lived across the street from the school and the school was at the top of the hill and our driveway was at the bottom. And my fellow class first graders thought it was great fun to push me down the hill and watch me go flying. And, you know, which didn't bother me at all. I've never been really thin-skinned about teasing because I see that as a way of including me. It's, you know, depending, you have to kind of be discerning and say, was that mean or was that just somebody being silly and being inclusive?
Yeah, there's a difference between ridicule.
Yes.
And teasing or being part of a group where people kind of push and shove at each other verbally.
Exactly. Exactly. And my mother long said, and my dad before he died would say, that child's tongue is going to be her undoing. Because I apparently from the word go, from just a very tiny age, was very quick-witted and quick with the comeback. And that hasn't changed any. You asked me about the wheelchair. I didn't go to a wheelchair full time until about 25 years ago. And I'll be 60 on March 17th, which I'm one of the oldest living women in the world with spina bifida. And that's kind of exciting.
Now, for the audience, what is spina bifida?
Okay. So spina bifida is a neural tube defect, which was one of Margaret Sanger's really hated disabilities. And she thought that anybody diagnosed with a neural tube defect should be sent on to their great reward in heaven. And, or if you want to put it politely, she thought they should be euthanized. And,
well, they were called pernicious weeds by her.
Exactly. Exactly. So spina bifida is a neural tube defect. It happens in utero during the baby's development. It can take various forms, but what it means at its base is that there is a split in the spine somewhere. There is a split in the neurological network. My malformation is at the top of my spine under my skull, right where the spine and the skull and the stem and the cord and the brain all come together. And so it was not noticeable because it's under my hairline. But most babies born with spina bifida are born with it below the rib cage, and it's usually a big bulge of tissue that shows up outside the skin. And they now have surgery that they can operate on the baby in utero and seal up that place so that the baby is born without a disability or with smaller limitations than they would otherwise have been born. But it was very obvious that for me from the beginning, but they did not have the technology to determine what the problem was until 1993, when MRIs and CAT scans really started becoming widely available. And when they found the malformation, the doctor walked in and told me I had a cancerous brain tumor and I needed to get my affairs in order.
Wow, you've had a good time with doctors, haven't you?
Yeah, there's more. But, you know, I giggle because it has become, I'm glad that everything that I've gone through has happened because it's made me a much better advocate, both for myself and other people. And I can say when people on the Hill, members of Congress and their staffers or people in the administration say, well, we don't think that there's any discrimination in healthcare toward people with disabilities. And I can tell my own stories and the stories of other people that are documented. And there's an immediate shift in the room of, all right, we need to take this a little more seriously.
Yeah, I want to get into the discrimination in healthcare just a little bit later.
Sure.
But beyond the healthcare issue, did you face discrimination growing up, and particularly once you became an adult and started moving into the professional realm?
Well, heavens, yes. I had my close circle of friends growing up that, you know, knew that I was just like everybody else, but I didn't get invited to birthday parties unless the whole class was invited. I it was so funny because we grew up in Northwest. I grew up in Northwest Atlanta before we moved back to Tennessee, which is where my family is from. And they had this cotillion thing for seventh graders. Seventh grade girls and boys went to cotillion, which is basically manners training and charm school. And I was not included because of my disability. And again, my mama went down there and said, listen, my daughter is going to have to function in a social capacity, and I want my daughter taught all the same things that all the other little seventh grade girls are learning, and you will include her. And
let me interrupt just for a second. A little curious. You said you weren't using a wheelchair at that time. How did your disability manifest? Were you having difficulty walking?
I had difficulty walking. I had hand-eye coordination problems. And we thought that I was just not a math person. And we didn't find out until I was an adult and into a teaching job that I had numeric dyslexia. And so it manifested in that my head is a little large for my body. Jackie Kennedy Onassis had the same problem. She always looked good in pictures. So I'd like to think that that's why I photograph well. So she and I share the bizarre pleasure and bizarre distinction of being in the top 1% of head size to body height and size ratio. And so it's interesting. And so you could see from that. If you feel my head, I have a couple of places where my skull never closed, which I'm hydrocephalic, so I never had to have a shunt because of that. I would have these little lumps show up on my head. Oh, Melissa, you've got too much fluid in your head right now. Go lay down and stretch out and it'll fix itself. But it manifested in that I couldn't keep up with everybody else physically. I looked like a cross between a Weeble and a Goonie Bird when I walked. And to share an anecdote about that, when I was in college, a dear friend nicknamed me Weeble, and he wasn't being sweet. He was being a little bit obnoxious. And I whipped around and I said to him with a full plate tray of food in my hands and my forearm crutches I was leaning on. And I said, yes, I may be a Weeble, and Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down, do they? And I was very arrogant about the whole thing. Turned around to walk back to my table to sit down, got tangled in my crutches and landed on my face on the floor with mashed potatoes on my forehead. So I learned that if I was going to rebut some of the teasing, I needed to be really sure that I was steady in my chair before I did so.
Well, let's get to your work at Capability Consulting. What is that organization and what is your purpose?
Capability Consulting is a one-stop shop that deals with all things disability policy. I do ADA compliance consulting. One of the things that we're running into in the conservative movement, as more people age and as more people with disabilities come into the movement, we're having to learn how to do accessible events, because any event that is public that can be publicly attended by paying a registration fee has to be made accessible. So I do ADA compliance about how to make the literature accessible, the PowerPoint presentations, how to do narrative for the video presentations, and how to find an ASL, American Sign Language interpreter, if needed. And one of the first places that I start is with the registration form. There has to be on every registration form a space that says, do you have any allergies and do you need any accessibility accommodations? And so that's where the person that needs it puts it down. And then that's where the conference organizers have to legally take it forward and make it work.
And is this because of the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Yes, it is. That's what ADA stands for, is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I get a lot of pushback from our side of the aisle about the ADA. And it was our side of the aisle that passed the ADA and worked in concert
with
the other.
You're talking about conservatives.
Yes, conservatives. Yeah. Sorry. So we people think it's government overreach, but it's really not. It's smart business, because people with disabilities have money to spend, and they can't spend it at your business if you don't make it accessible for them to spend it. And I believe that the Americans with Disabilities Act is just an extension of the Bill of Rights, We have the right, you know, the right to assemble. We have to be able to get there to assemble, to get in there. So
that's very interesting. I do want to talk more about the Americans with Disabilities Act, but I'm still trying to get people to know you a little bit. You've set up a nonprofit called Compassionate Capability, in which you, the organization offers micro grants.
Yes.
What is the nonprofit and what is the purpose of the micro grants?
The nonprofit is called, Compassionate Capability, and the purpose is we scaled back because I've had some health problems. So we are going to ramp up within the next year, the nonprof. It is to offer micro grants to people for making their homes accessible, getting books on tape if they need that. It's to help people live and flourish in American society.
And that's a nonprofit, so that if anyone wanted to contribute, that's tax deductible, correct?
Yes. And as soon as my 501c3 goes through.
Yeah, we have, once that's done, we have put the link in the program notes if people are interested. So basically, the idea is that people will be applying for micro grants to help set up homes or businesses or their lives so that they can actually get around better and access all that life has to give.
Yes. I think our founding fathers wanted everybody to participate. I'm not sure they articulated that clearly all the time because we have all these amendments and new laws, but I believe that our founding fathers felt like everybody was created equal in the sight of God, and they wanted to create an environment where human beings could flourish with strong personal freedom and limited government intervention.
At the very least, they set up a system that could move in that direction because, you know, we don't have to get into our founders' flaws, but they didn't necessarily live what they said they believed.
No.
But that's for another show. You know, disability is a pretty broad term that can apply to physical, emotional, and cognitive challenges. Is there a legal definition that we should know about? And how would you describe the term?
This is an issue because there are legal definitions across the executive branch. Like, you might be considered disabled and eligible for accessible housing, but not be considered disabled and eligible for workplace accommodation, depending on how it's being defined. I define disability as any permanent situation that impacts your daily living abilities, your activities of daily living, your ability to get dressed, your ability to maintain hygiene, your ability to go out and earn a living, your ability to participate in your society. And it's not, let me state very clearly what it isn't. It isn't transgenderism. Transgenderism is not a disability. It's a lifestyle choice. A disability is, again, anything that impacts your activities of daily living. And, you know, whether it's not being able to understand what someone is saying to you because you are autistic, or not being able to make yourself understood because you have a communication disability, it is this idea that, you know, my dexterity isn't like everybody else's, so I have to have the levers on the doors instead of doorknobs that twist, things like that.
Approximately, you know, there's an awful lot of, as you said, conditions that can go into that term. Approximately how many people have disabilities in the United States?
There are 61 million Americans with disabilities.
And for those of us who aren't, I've heard a term that I think is quite interesting, TABS, temporarily able-bodied, meaning that people may not be disabled today, but you never know what's coming tomorrow.
Exactly. I love that. TABS, temporarily able-bodied. That's great. Because we are all one accident, one illness, one injury away from becoming disabled. It's the easiest minority to join.
The Americans with Disabilities Act, which we've already discussed just briefly, I think is the movement's greatest triumph. Tell us a little bit about the effort that went into getting that law passed and some of the things that it requires.
There was a lot of effort starting way back in the Reagan era, even before the Reagan era. There were efforts to pass this law, bring it into reality, and it is a fully bipartisan effort. It was fully bipartisan, and And I know that you'll recognize the name C. Boyd and Gray.
Yes, so C. Boyd and Gray. He was a lawyer. Yeah.
Yes, he was a lawyer, and he was in both the Reagan and Bush 41 administration. He may have been in 43 as well, but what I'm talking about pertains to Reagan and then Bush 41. He talked about the need for this law. Ted Cruz worked on this law. There are lots of different people that worked on the policy side of this law. But you had to bring the left and the right together to pass it. And so C. Boyd and Gray was one of the people who made inroads with the Democrats. And there was a man whose name escapes me at the moment. I am just coming out of a long period of illness, so I'm still having brain fog every once in a while. And this guy's name is escaping me, but he was a very well-known Democrat. And C. Boyd and Gray would play cards with him once a week. And they mapped out the process to get this together. Johnny Erickson Tata, who many evangelicals will recognize her name.
She's been on Humanized, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah, so you can listen to that sometime.
I will. She's my dear friend. She was very involved in the formulation of the ADA. She helped get the Christian community behind it.
For people who may not know, Johnny Erickson Tata had an accident, a swimming accident, I believe, became quadriplegic, became world famous because she was able to paint using her a paintbrush in her mouth.
Yes.
And eventually started a ministry where she gives wheelchairs throughout the world to people with disabilities and provides other services and ministrations to people with disabilities around the world. She's a remarkable woman.
She's incredible. And she is the oldest living female quadriplegic in the world. And the thing that makes her story so remarkable is that she just went on and lived her life. She lives it on four wheels or six wheels, depending on the type of wheelchair. And she got married. She got married when I was in high school. And I remember seeing it all over the news that she had gotten married. And I was so excited because it gave me hope that one day I could get married.
And I did.
Yes. And had to kiss a lot of frogs before I found the prince. I found him and he's awesome. And
I'm going to tell him when you said that.
We joke about that a lot. And I was kind of his one and only serious relationship. He's very steady and very stoic. And once he decided he was in love with me, that was that.
Well, that's great.
Oh, wonderful. But let's finish talking about the ADA real quick. Yeah. The ADA says that anything that is available to an able-bodied person has to be made available and made accessible to someone with a disability.
So you're talking about things like being able to get into a shop.
Yes, ramps and lowered counters and widened aisles. And aisles are supposed to be 4 feet wide so that people can get up and down them. And it's very interesting because we lived in New York City after we first got married, because that's where my husband is from. And I went there after we got married. And in New York City, they like to claim that since some of those buildings were built before 1990, they have exclusion. No, they don't have grandfathering, and they were given 20 extra years to make things accessible. So that's one of the common misunderstandings of grandfathering in the ADA. Churches and other faith-based institutions were given a pass, except for colleges. Were given a pass on being made fully accessible. I've never understood. It's been explained to me by several different people, but it was what they had to do in order to get the legislation passed through both the House and the Senate. Then in 1990, the late summer, early fall of 1990, people with disabilities crawled up the Capitol steps to say to the Senate, okay, the House has passed this, the Senate needs to pass it, and the President needs to sign it. And, I didn't actually climb the steps, but I was there on the patio that day when it happened. And it was...
That must have been powerful.
It was incredible. And this isn't talked about a lot, but what meant so much to me was the way the Capitol Police dealt with it. They actually climbed with and stayed right with people to make sure that they didn't get injured. They didn't get dehydrated. They didn't get hurt. And that was beautiful. The Capitol Police were amazing in that moment. And then I was in the gallery the night that it passed the Senate. And for the first time, I mean, I've always felt a part of things. I became politically active at the age of 4, and we can get to that in a second. Yes, I was 4, and I had just finished my second internship in Washington when the bill passed the Senate. And I had always felt a part of things, but I knew for the people that didn't feel a part of things, that didn't have the family structure that I had to make sure that I was included in things and to make me believe in myself and what I had to offer, that this law was going to be powerful.
And do you think it has made the kind of difference that you all hoped for when you were advocating?
Not yet. Justin Dart, who is one of the founders of the modern disability movement, said something the night that the ADA was signed. They went back to the National Council on Disability and had champagne to celebrate the Rose Garden signing. And he said, you can legislate access, but you can't legislate acceptance. You can't legislate attitudes of the heart. And we have a long way to go in our attitude of accepting people that are less than what that we would consider less than, or that are just different from us for whatever reason. We don't have to endorse somebody's lifestyle, but we do need to honor their imago Deo, their humanity.
I think in terms of disability, there's also a lot of fear.
That
people are afraid that this could end up being me. Mm-hmm. And when you're able-bodied, for many people, and we're going to talk about assisted suicide in just a bit, but for many people, being disabled is worse than death. And that's why, that movement has actually gone, through the society, because there's a great deal of fear.
There's a great deal of fear. There's a great deal of misunderstanding. I taught school for 10 years, and my first year teaching, I was hired after Labor Day. And in the South, school starts early August. And so the kids had been in school for a month when I was brought in as a high school English and government teacher. And I hadn't been there a week before my principal got a call from a parent stating, I don't want my student in that classroom with a woman who can't walk properly, if at all. She can't control those students. She can't teach. What if a fight breaks out and my child gets hurt because this woman couldn't break up the fight? The school board got phone calls. My principal was absolutely amazing. He stood with me and he fought for my right to teach there. And the kids were fabulous. They could have cared less. And the ones that had their own like learning disabilities and things like that, they were annoyed with me because I was breaking the narrative that they had told themselves of what they could not do.
That could be a real trap.
That absolutely, it can be a real trap. And people with disabilities of any kind are in that trap of the tyranny of lowered expectations. I am grateful that My dad died when I was 5. And so my mother at 38 found herself with a 5-year-old with a profound disability and a 15-year-old who was, pardon the expression, but hell on wheels going somewhere to happen. And I still live in awe of my sister because she's something else. But it was a lot for my mother to take. But I was still expected, like any other child, to get up and make my bed. I was supposedly expected to keep my room picked up. And that was a constant battle. I was expected to do my homework. I was expected to share my toys and live in community with other kids my age. I was not given a pass on behavior. And what I saw when I got into the classroom and what I still see now is that anybody with any kind of physical or intellectual developmental disability is given a pass when they don't behave properly.
And that's a mistake, you're saying?
It's a huge mistake. Now, if it's sensory overload, I do understand with autism and other sensory disabilities, it's very difficult to rein in those emotions and things like that. You don't make an allowance for that, but you learn how to manage it so it doesn't impact other people.
I think what you talked about in terms of your mother is important in terms of the overall issue, which is accommodation doesn't mean doing everything for one. Mm-hmm. That people are expected to take care of themselves to the best of their capacity, and that any difference then will be the accommodation. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And I mean, I got my behind beat with the switch when I didn't behave. And people thought my mother was horrible because here's this, as they used to call me, the poor little crippled girl And my mother stuck to her guns and she said she has a smart mouth. She has a strong, stubborn streak. And if I don't get these things under control, she's going to be incorrigible before she's 16. And my mother wasn't wrong because I am pretty incorrigible as it is now as an almost 60-year-old woman, but well-behaved women rarely make history, and I enjoy being not well-behaved when it's appropriate. The thing that she gave me, though, was an idea that in order to function in society, I was going to have appropriate behavior, manners. I had to chew with my mouth closed. For people with neurological problems, learning to chew with the mouth closed is almost a non-starter. It's very, very difficult because of something about the way the whole facial structure works. And one of my earliest memories of being a person is having supper at the governor's mansion in Atlanta, Georgia, with a little sign beside my plate, very nicely done, all decorated up and sitting on a little bitty gold easel. And it said, "Lips together, please."
Wow.
And I was expected to learn to chew. And we didn't know until I started doing research I was 17 when I really started doing research into living with a disability and what other people faced and things like that. We didn't know that I wasn't supposed to be able to chew with my mouth closed because of the type of disability I had. But I'm glad I didn't know that because I learned how to do it.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things in life that I have learned how to do either the way everybody else does them or through an adaptive way that works for me that I didn't know I was not supposed to be able to do.
That's interesting because I from looking at on the outside in to this movement, sometimes it strikes me that there is this sense of, well, because I'm disabled, I'm entitled to this or I'm entitled to that. And it goes beyond what we were describing before of making up the difference.
Yes. There is a sense of entitlement. And it makes me crazy because we worked so hard as a movement to be seen as people. And in the Americans with Disabilities Act, there's a whole section on language about using people first language. Person with a disability, person who is blind, person who is deaf, focusing on that personhood. And I think that that's one of the most beautiful things that we can possibly do. Now, especially because of the rise in diagnosed autism, you have a whole group of kids that are just now kind of getting out of college and entering the workforce. I'd say the 20 to 40. 20-something to 40, early 40-something, that 20-year generation, they have this idea that they're supposed to be taken care of and that everything is due them. They're like, I'm guaranteed life, liberty, and happiness. No, no, no. You're guaranteed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What you make of your life is your deal and your business and it's what you get out there and scratch and do with the best that you use, as Irma Bombeck said, she said, "I want to go skating into heaven saying to God, I used everything you gave me."
Yeah. I think this is an issue that cuts across many, many different controversies where certain guidelines are established and they very quickly kind of melt and become much more all-encompassing. I'm just give you another example, which isn't the subject we're talking about, but I lived in San Francisco when the AIDS catastrophe was ongoing, and a program was set up called Needle Exchange, where a drug addict would bring in, or somebody who was using drugs would have to bring in dirty needles to get clean needles. And eventually the bringing in the dirty needles stopped and it was just needle giveaway. And this is the kind of thing. So that's what they do now. Just give needle giveaway, which is why San Francisco has needles on sidewalks and in playgrounds and so forth. But there's this temptation to move from, okay, we've created this structure with the ADA for equality, and the structure eventually kind of cracks. And there are some well-meaning activists, but I think they do a disservice that then seek to break through the structure and create, as we discussed, entitlements.
Exactly. And there is a move. There are two moves in the disability community right now that scare the snot out of me. And I'm not just snot crying over them. I'm scared to death that it's going to become reality. Two things. First of all, vote by phone, where you don't even have to send in a ballot. You just pull it up on your phone. No ID, no ballot, no signature. Well, I think that there may be on some of the software apps that are being bandied about a place for a signature, because that's supposed to make it easier for people with disabilities to vote. Last I checked, the election law in the United States states very clearly that all voting polls must be accessible. And there is no way around that. They must be accessible.
And that's an important rule.
It's an extremely important rule. Then the other one is universal basic income. The disability movement seems to think that Social Security disability and Social Security income need to be expanded so that anybody that feels like they need a little help with their daily needs can get universal basic income, whether or not they want to work. Well, when I was coming along, and my family had a farm in Tennessee, and I jokingly referred to my grandfather as a gentleman farmer because he had a whole career as a pipe fitter and doing some other supervisory things, but he also had this farm. I was expected from the time that I was old enough to pull a tobacco stake out of the ground, or I was old enough to pick up something off the ground that had fallen off the truck, to pick that stuff up and help get the crops in and help. You know, I can remember snapping beans with my grandmother when I was six, and I got paid for snapping those beans. It wasn't a lot of money, but I got paid. And we have lost a work ethic in this country because of disability income, because of disability entitlements and things like Medicaid and SNAP and things like that. We've lost a work ethic, and we've got to seriously examine the laws surrounding all of those things, because right now the guidelines, because what we have now are unelected bureaucrats who are telling people who need a safety net how to use it as a hammock.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I can't believe it. We're already beginning to run out of time.
Well, I have all the time you need.
Basically scratched the surface. Let's talk about the ADA and healthcare. My understanding is that the ADA does not prohibit discrimination in healthcare. Is that right?
No. They have the ADA is supposed to, you have to have a hospital room that's accessible for wheelchairs.
Yeah, but that's accessibility. It's not care.
Correct. Okay. I'm sorry. I wasn't making the distinction in my own brain. Oh, and there's a triage system that's used. We saw it during COVID, that if somebody is considered less productive, they don't get as much resources or as much help. And I'll tell you what happened. Just a very quick story about me. I was diagnosed on January 6th, 2021. That's that January 6th. I got a diagnosis of stage 2 breast cancer, and very unexpected. And we mapped out a treatment plan. I was going to have the surgery, and then I was going to have chemo and then radiation and then chemo if I needed it once the other two things had happened. All of a sudden, without my consent, the treatment plan was changed to, they wanted to do chemo, then surgery, then radiation. And I said, no. I said, if I really want to do the surgery first so that we can get that out of the way, because of the way that I move my body, the mastectomy is going to make it very difficult for me to transfer my body in and out of bed, in and out of the wheelchair, in and out off the toilet, that kind of thing. I need to, let's just get this done so that if we do chemo first, I'll be too weak to take care of myself after the surgery as needed. And my husband doesn't need any more on his plate. He is also my primary caregiver. So they relented and they said, well, we're still going to do the radiation last. And I said, why? And they said, that's just the decision that's been made by the hospital. Come to find out way down the track that the reason they had made that decision is that they did not have a Hoyer lift, and all hospitals are supposed to have them, that would lift me out of my wheelchair onto the radiation table.
So they were violating what would normally be the standard of care.
Correct.
Because they were unable to accommodate your disability in providing care and treatment.
They didn't want to buy a Hoyer lift. There was a Hoyer lift in one part of the hospital, but they didn't want to buy a Hoyer lift for the radiology department.
The thing that I've talked to a lot of people with disabilities is that They will go into a hospital and they will be offered a do not resuscitate order under circumstances in which an able-bodied person would not be
Correct.
Offered a DNR.
Correct.
And that's a very strong act of discrimination because
yes,
they're basically saying, why should we save your life and why would you want your life to be saved?
That is, and I've dealt with that more times than I care to think about. Most recently dealing with discrimination in healthcare. In November, sorry, I told you I've not been feeling well, so I'm a little foggy here. In November, I was in my infectious diseases doctor's office and I began to go blue about the mouth. And I was breathing pretty shallow and rapid and my chest was hurting. And she said, Melissa, she said, I'm going to walk you down to the ER right now so that we can get you checked out. Cause she said, I think you're having a heart attack. And instead of laying me flat to do the EEG, the way they are, EKG, the way they are supposed to do, they kept me in my wheelchair. And because I'm a cancer patient, I already have a cardiologist and I called him as soon as I was out of the emergency room. And I said, they refused to put me on the gurney to do the EKG. And he said, then the EKG is not accurate. And when I got to his office, they redid the EKG and that changed the results completely.
You know, I was a friend of Mark O'Brien. I don't know if you know who he was.
I know the name.
Mark O'Brien had polio when he was 6.
Mm.
And he spent the rest of his life in an iron lung.
Oh my goodness.
And he had a movie made about him called Breathing Lessons that won an Academy Award. And he was a early campaigner for the independent living movement,
yes,
which I'd like to ask you about in just a second. And he had a catastrophe where the power went out on his and the redundancy on his iron lung. He lived in his own apartment, and I went to visit him in the hospital, and the doctor wanted to discharge him immediately, and Mark thought he needed one extra day to get better. And instead of talking to Mark, the doctor started talking to me, who was the visitor.
Yep.
Who was able-bodied. And I said, don't look at me. I'm not your patient. Talk to Mark. And Mark said it was maddening that used to happen to him all the time.
That is the story of my life. And there are people who have acted like Tony is committing some sort of crime by being married to me, that he's taking advantage of a vulnerable woman. I'm blessed that my mom and dad realized early on that I had a lot going on in my brain and that I was communicating. Told off my first doctor when I was 3. And that was the beginning of my long line of advocacy and for what it's worth. And I'm happy to share that story in just a second, but it's maddening to me that people would look at me and then look at my parents or look at whoever was with me at the doctor and then ask what they were going to do. And I remember one doctor that I just looked at and said, I am 25 years old. My mother is here with me because I had a grand mal seizure and I can't drive until I'm cleared. I had a grand mal seizure because of anesthesia that had never been used on me before, and I had a bad reaction to it. I am not an imbecile. I am not incompetent. And just so you know, I work at the Tennessee State Legislature, and they all trust me with my communication skills. Why don't you?
Yeah.
And
Do you think that medical school needs to help educate doctors and nurses and other professionals on communicating with people with disabilities?
It's really funny you should ask that, because I'm in the process of writing a curriculum for a one-day seminar I'm going to pitch it to all the medical schools across the United States and Canada. And I'd pitch it in Mexico if I spoke Spanish, but I don't. I'm married into a Hispanic family, but they speak English at home. So it's never been a need. There needs to be a whole curriculum taught, and people with disabilities need to be the ones to come in and teach it about how to properly interact with people with disabilities, how to properly listen, speak, and how to communicate in a way that's understood and make the person with the disability a full participant in their medical care. And
yeah, I think that's really crucial. It's hard enough for able-bodied people to get that going.
Yes.
And I think as the experience I had with Mark as an example, people with disabilities have an even a tougher time sometimes, but that stuff is not covered by the ADA.
No, no.
And that's it an seems to me
of the heart again.
It does seem to me that the ADA could use updating.
Yes.
To include, provisions that people with disabilities cannot be discriminated against. For example, the DNR for the person with a disability, but not the DNR for the person without the disability. So is that an agenda item on the disability there rights?
Yes, I would encourage you, and I'll make the connection. I have a friend who is the executive director of a group called Not Dead Yet.
Yes, I know. I knew Diane Coleman.
Yes. So, yeah. So this is Ian, who is her successor. And I know that one of their agenda items is something like that is non-discrimination in healthcare. People with disabilities, like Down syndrome, and other forms of intellectual developmental disabilities are routinely discriminated against in organ donation, organ transplant recipients, things like that. They are told that they cannot receive organ transplants that they desperately need to stay alive because it's thought that they can't manage the protocols. If anything, people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, if they're high functioning enough, they have learned to live in a routine. And that routine is exactly what the regimen is.
But since we're talking about Not Dead Yet, Not Dead Yet was founded to fight assisted suicide.
Correct.
And their first direct action, they disability rights activists can do some things in terms of direct actions that other people can't. Mm-hmm. And the first two things they did, as I recall, because as you know, I've been fighting the euthanasia assisted suicide movement for more than 30 years.
Yes.
Is they demonstrated in front of Jack Kevorkian's house. Jack Kevorkian, for those who may not remember, was assisting the suicide of mostly people with disabilities using carbon monoxide. And the second thing they did is they occupied the offices of what was then called the Hemlock Society at that time in Denver, and it's now called Compassion and Choices. And so the disability rights movement, I think, have been the most effective opponents of legalizing assisted suicide in the country, particularly in states that are more liberal or progressive politically than other states. For example, pro-lifers in a blue state, to use that term, won't have any influence, but disability rights activists will. So a lot of people don't understand why disability rights activists would oppose assisted suicide. They say, wait a minute, this is for your benefit. So what do you have to say to that?
What I have to say to that is my life is worth everything. From a faith standard, if my life was worth Jesus dying on the cross, then my life is worth living to the best of my ability and not to be snuffed out because somebody thinks I'm too expensive. Suffering has meaning. The suffering that I've gone through as a person with a disability, the cancer, the COVID, the CHF now, has taught me more about character and character traits that I still need to develop more strongly. And I want to be an encouragement to people who either are temporarily able-bodied, or newly disabled, that they too can have this very full, very wonderful life. And that having a disability, having a terminal illness, does not mean that things should be cut short. I think people should live out all their days in their best, least restrictive environment.
Of course, most countries don't limit assisted suicide and euthanasia to the terminally ill. This isn't the subject of this particular program, but that is a SOP to get the foot in the door, if you will, use that cliche. In fact, most countries allow lethal jabs for people with disabilities because they believe that the suffering is such that it's actually a blessing. And what you're saying is that people with disabilities should not be killed any more than healthy people or people who are able-bodied should be killed.
And I mean, we're seeing people who are older being in states where it's legal being kind of coerced into deciding this if they get just a little bit inconvenient for their family members. And I'd think that that is completely outside the realm of what a Judeo-Christian society that we're supposed to be. I think we're a postmodern society now that we don't have any more ethics, that we are supposed to honor humanity and to ease the suffering with proper hospice care, with proper pain management, with proper support and not proper support and not end someone's life prematurely because they might be suffering. Who are you, not you specifically, Wesley, who are any of us, let's put it that way, to tell someone else that their suffering is too much and they need to consider this?
But the response advocates for assisted suicide would say, well, we don't want to do that, but we want people to be able to say, I'm suffering more than I can handle, so I want it to end.
Well, they can do that without an assisted suicide law. It is, you do not need a physician's help to end your life. It is quite easy to overdose on a pain med or an over-the-counter drug. It's quite easy to overdose and take your own life. You don't need a physician's help.
Yeah, I would point out that compassion means to suffer with. That's the
correct
meaning of the word compassion. And that assisted suicide doesn't suffer with anybody. It discards the problem. I would also point out that the statistics show and the demographics show that people are not committing assisted suicide because of untreatable pain, but rather things that people with disabilities, and this is why Not Dead Yet was formed, have to deal with every day. That is worries about losing dignity, worries about being unable to enjoy personal activities, worries about being a burden. And I do want to get to the B word in just a minute. But let's, because we're really running out of time here, I would like you to address real quickly the independent living movement, and then why should employers hire people with disabilities?
Okay, let me do that in reverse. Employers should hire people with disabilities because they have a strong work ethic, they are grateful for the opportunity, and they will show up and work harder than most of your non-disabled employees. And I've seen it firsthand. I've lived it, and I've seen it in other people. With the independent living movement, part of being fully integrated into the fabric of American society is being able to live as independently as possible, to live in your least restrictive environment. And I fully support the independent living movement's plan for that and their work toward that end. I'm very concerned about the Section 504 lawsuits that are coming back up after I thought we had quashed them. They're coming back up in Texas and Iowa and several other states because supposedly providing home and community-based services are more costly than sticking people in institutions where they have no autonomy.
So you used a bit of jargon there. What does that mean?
Okay. 504 is a section of the Rehab Act that guarantees independent living in the least restrictive environment with community and home-based supports. That's like, instead of me living in a nursing home, I'm able to live in a condominium of my choosing with my husband, who, yes, he is my caregiver, but if it gets to the point that he can't do it by himself, he's not going to put me in a nursing home. We're going to bring somebody into our home to help with activities of daily living, and insurance will cover that. And then I used 504, and the least restrictive environment is, that jargon basically means whatever is the easiest environment for me to function in, or anybody with a disability. And it's different from disability to disability. The most important thing about the independent living movement is that it keeps people with disabilities in the community, and it lets them feel like they are a part of the community.
Mark O'Brien, who I referenced before,
yes,
he was a single man, but he was able to hire his own caregiver, and he could fire his own caregiver because sometimes the caregivers were not doing the job. And it was very important to him. And as a consequence of that, he was able to become a journalist and a published poet. As I said, an award-winning documentary called Breathing Lessons was made from his story. And he died at age 50 from the post-polio syndrome. But he lived as good and full a life as possible under his circumstances, in large part because he was not stuck in some ward.
Correct.
In an iron lung, but he was able to to have agency in his own life.
Correct. And the problem with living in a nursing home setting is you don't get to choose your caregivers. You're stuck with whoever they put on your case that day. And nursing,
and it's depressing.
It's depressing. And nursing home abuse is real. And it is deadly for people with disabilities and elderly people.
As we wind down here, I do want to talk about the language. You have a, you sent me a list of words that are not kosher, to use a term.
Correct.
And others that, and how to say things properly. Why is it important that we police our language?
Language matters because it assigns dignity. It embraces the idea of dignity. Language creates thought. Thoughts create language, create thoughts. And, you know, the things that we speak over ourselves are the things that we learn to believe about ourselves. The things that are spoken over us are the things that we learn to believe about ourselves. And using the right language is a building block as opposed to a stumbling block and a wine press of pressing down.
So you're not talking about what used to be called politically correct, or sometimes these days is called woke.
No.
You're talking about treating people with respect.
Correct.
And dignity with the language we use. So you say, for example, no one wants to be referred to as a burden.
Correct. Nobody does. I don't like being called a burden. I don't like feeling like a burden.
And you say, don't use the word handicap or handicapped.
Yes. Correct.
And why is that?
The etymology on that, by the way, I'm a word nerd, so I love knowing where words come from. The etymology, which means the history of the word, handicapped, comes from after World War I, when World War I veterans, the only way that they could support their families and themselves was to dress up in their uniform and take their caps off, hold it in their hand, and beg for money. Veterans who were wounded, who couldn't find jobs. That's what they were left to do. And begging is one of the most demoralizing, dehumanizing things that you can possibly do.
So if when I see it says handicap placard or handicap sign for parking, the people who did that were not trying to be insulting.
No, we've just never, it should be changed to wheelchair accessible parking. And in some places, Walmart has done really well with a lot of their stores that they write van accessible parking, and they put the universal handicap sign on it, wheelchair sign, disability sign. It's the phrase handicap parking is so ingrained in our language that it's almost become an idiom. And I think trying to change it to accessible parking, it's a mouthful, but I try to use it. And you have to kind of pick your battle on that one, pick your moments on that one. But it's so important that we use words that build people up instead of tearing them down. Another one that I get tickled with all the time, and that I am constantly tweeting to news agencies about, is please stop saying wheelchair bound. People who use wheelchairs are not tied to their wheelchairs. It is not a crisis. It is not a tragedy that somebody is in a wheelchair. It is the reality of their life and how they are able, that wheelchair, that mobility aid enables them to live a very much more full, productive life.
It's a tool.
Yes.
Just like my glasses. I wear glasses. I'm not glasses bound.
Correct. And I was meeting with Grover Norquist about this idea, and he said, so would I be considered disabled if I took my glasses off? I said, can you see without your glasses? And he said, no. I said, then you have a visual aid. You have a visual impairment, and your glasses are a tool to help you see. And he said, oh, all right.
I'm going to use one more word, and this word drives people I know who are disability rights activists literally up a wall, and that's retarded.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me, because when I grew up, that was the term that was used for people with developmental disabilities. Yeah. Or cognitive disabilities.
Yes.
Why is retarded so, it's almost like the R word.
Yeah, it's the R word. It's like the N word. It's like...
You think it's demeaning in that sense, that depth of dehumanization?
Because all we know, it's what's conjured up in your mind when you hear the word. Retarded conjures up somebody that drools, somebody that can't, it's to use a really gross terminology, the lights are on, but nobody's home. It conjures up someone that isn't functional at all, not just someone who has a developmental problem or an intellectual problem. It conjures up someone who's not functional, or someone, you know, conjures up somebody that was put on the short bus to go to school and segregated from his peers because he couldn't comprehend things. It's just such a negative stereotype. In the same way that blackface is a negative stereotype for African Americans.
So we should not use that.
No.
Because we should not hurt people that way.
No. And it's breaking my heart to hear the administration that we worked so hard to get elected because of the good things that they were going to do and are doing. It's breaking my heart to hear so many people in the current administration use that word with abandon.
You're pro-life.
Very much so.
Many in the disability rights movement are not.
No.
Even though eugenics, abortion, you know, there's search and destroy missions for people with Down syndrome, babies with Down syndrome, people with spina bifida.
Correct.
People even with a cleft palate.
Yes.
Might be aborted. So what I have never understood is how disability rights activists who are so righteous when it comes to accessing health care, fighting against euthanasia and assisted suicide, seem to turn a indifference to the search and destroy mission that takes out their brothers and sisters in the womb.
Correct. It's a bodily autonomy issue. They have bought into this idea that the right to terminate a pregnancy, the right to kill a baby in the womb, is a bodily autonomy issue. And they're all about bodily autonomy as people with disabilities. So they've bought into it that way instead of this idea that, oh, wait, that's another body inside of a body. You can't do anything.
So what you're saying is they're relating to the woman who doesn't want to be pregnant rather than the gestating baby that would have a disability.
Yes, yes. And it's the same thing. One of the worst mistakes that the disability movement has made is in hitching their wagon to the LGBTQ movement.
Which also has to do with autonomy and living the life the way I want to live it.
Correct. And that's why they did it, because there was this idea of strength in numbers and justice for everybody. Well, as we're seeing now with some of the young men and young women who are detransitioning, transgenderism isn't justice, and it ruins your life. And it's a lifestyle choice. It is not, it is a mental illness and a lifestyle choice, not a right. You don't have the right to do whatever you want to your body because of what's going to happen to it.
And particularly, in my view, children need to be protected in that regard.
Absolutely.
We're out of time, but I would like to ask, what reform do you believe is most urgently needed to guarantee equality for people with disabilities?
Oh my goodness. I think the biggest reform is to get unelected bureaucrats out of the way when accessing government benefits, government and government supports, so that people with disabilities are able, according to the law, to access Medicaid if they need it to support their ability to live independently. But what, and even if they work, and what they're told is, my gosh, don't work, because you'll lose your Medicaid. That's not exactly true. The biggest reform that needs to happen is that the parameters around being identified as a person with a disability and getting the supports that you need from a government that wants to provide a support system, not a hammock, is to get the definition of disability standardized across the federal departments and state departments, and then get unelected bureaucrats out of the way, teach people with disabilities what the statutes actually say, and help them learn to advocate for that.
And live, as you said, as independently as they can, receiving assistance for the areas that they need some support.
That's the biggest thing. And the other thing is, I would love to see us go from using the phrase able-bodied to work capable. My mother, until about a year before she died, at the age of 92, was able to work circles around most people half her age. She was work capable. I am work capable. I can't work circles around people depending on what, well, if it's policy and putting together an event, yeah, I can work circles around most people. But if it's digging a ditch, no, I can't do that, but I'm still work capable. We need to focus on the ability to work and the ability to produce. When I was 3 years
old. Which you think has to do with a life of dignity.
Yes, it does. It has everything to do with self-esteem and dignity. And I'll close out by telling just very quickly. I was at a campaign office when I was 3 years old. My dad was, one of the things that he did as an entrepreneur was political fundraising. And I know now that the person he handed me off to with my long strawberry blonde ponytails and my short leg metal braces and high top shoes and my frilly dress, he said, here, I have a fundraising meeting. Take her, do something with her. She can lick envelopes. She can stuff envelopes. She can lick stamps and she knows her numbers and letters. For the next 3 hours, the woman that he handed me to gave me task after task. I folded letters. I stuffed those envelopes. And then I gleefully licked all of those envelopes. It was before the tear off tab. I was 3 years old and I did the stamps and I said, now what? And she said, do you know how zip codes work? And she showed me how zip codes worked. And I got it in order by zip code. And by the time my dad came out, he said later that he knew I'd had a good time because I was disappointed to see him. And she came around to say goodbye and she said, come with me. And she took my hand and she walked me back to her desk and she opened her drawer and gave me two Kennedy half dollars. Now, I didn't know that those were only worth 50 cents a piece. I didn't know that. I just knew that they were shiny money. And I was 3 years old and I was getting paid because I worked. And she said, people that work get paid. And I have never forgotten that. And that is the work ethic that everybody should have, whether they are work capable or disabled or able-bodied or whatever you want to call it.
Wouldn't it be interesting if you could meet her again and she found out what a powerful experience that was for a little girl? Well, we're out of time and I've really enjoyed our conversation, learned a lot. What next for Melissa Ortiz?
Well, what's next for me is that I am trying to get better from this pulmonary and cardiac edema. I am speaking at a conference in April, and that's another part of capability consulting is that I am a professional speaker. I will come and speak on everything from disability policy to something to motivate you. I have all kinds of motivational speeches in my back pocket, and I talk about civic engagement from City Hall to the White House, proper way and to get your point across.
The link to the website will be with the program notes.
Perfect.
Well, Melissa, thank you very much. I appreciate your joining Humanize.
Thank you, Wesley.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.